Good day, everyone, and welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange conference call. Today's call is being recorded. Now for introductions, I'd like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Christy Snyder. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Steve, and welcome everyone to the WebSphere Technical Exchange. Today's topic is crashes on WebSphere, determining the source. At the end of today's session, the lines will open for a question and answer period. Today's presenter is James Fox. James joined the WebSphere Level 2 Java SDK support team in June of 2004. Prior to this, he worked in the WebSphere Performance Group as well as other roles within IBM in development, tests, and support. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to James Fox. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Once again, my name is James Fox, and today's topic is going to be debugging crashes in WebSphere, finding the source. I'd like to move on to page 2 and cover the agenda of what we hope to cover today. First, we're going to go through a brief introduction to cover the scope of what we intend to, the scope of the depth that we intend to cover. Then I'd like to go into prevention, which is really the first step to ensuring that we avoid the crashes altogether. After that, I'd like to cover the topic of the must-gather documents, which, if you're not familiar with those, then that's the support's way of collecting a necessary set of documents to debug a problem. After that, we'll get into the meat of the presentation, where we're going to start looking at the diagnostics that are produced by the different JVMs and determining how to basically find the point of origin or that needs to have the maintenance applied or needs to have support involved for resolution. So moving on to page 3, the scope, as I mentioned before, is to basically determine the source of the crash in this presentation. We're not going to be going into depth of debugging the crash itself. It's more of a method to determine which part of a large enterprise system could be the failing component in a crash so that we can target maintenance or get to the correct support group first if maintenance has already been applied. The reason that that I wanted to focus on this is that we found from our level 2 support perspective that the vast majority of our issues that come in are usually resolved by simply applying the latest maintenance update. Basically, if it's an issue of a crash within the JVM and you're on a service release of the JVM that's a few years old or may not be current, there's a good chance that that's already been addressed. So oftentimes simply updating the JVM or going along that path or determining which the failing component is and updating to the proper maintenance level of that component is the best path to resolution. If that is not the best path, if that does not resolve the issue, though, knowing in hand which group to engage, which can oftentimes in a large enterprise environment with many different components of the base WebSphere, other products on top, JDBC providers, third-party code, all the different components, knowing which component to engage first can help expedite the support process and basically reduce cycles. So moving on to slide 4, I'd like to define what I'm going to consider a crash in today's presentation. Of course, hopefully nobody's ever experienced one, but if you ever have, you probably know that a crash is basically when an application server process terminates unexpectedly due to software-related reasons. I'm not going to cover in today's presentation anything regarding hardware-related reasons, such as failing memory components or anything like that. That's certainly not the majority of issues that we see, so I'd like to focus mostly on the software-related reasons. Moving on to slide number 5, the sources of a crash are always going to occur when the application is executing C code of some sort. What I mean by this is that Java code that you've written or programmed, it will throw errors and it will throw exceptions within the Java virtual machine, but it should never crash and terminate the process unexpectedly. When you do have a crash, this is when you have either the JVM itself, its support libraries, which meaning the libraries that run and interpret the language to your native platform, the JIT compiler running, which is the just-in-time compiler, which takes the Java code and compiled it to the native language so that it can run faster, basically, or support library code, or JNI code, which is a code that runs through the Java native interface, such as JDBC drivers or anything where the Java code has to go over a bridge and communicate to native or C code, or the JIT-generated code itself, when the code has been JIT compiled or the JIT compiler has run and it's converted it basically to native code, and it's running and executing. So those are always going to be the sources of a crash. There's also the main types that we see are going to be segmentation violation. That's going to be our number one hitter. This is where basically the instruction of an application process accesses a bad or corrupt pointer. This, once again, going back to C code. Another kind that we see somewhat frequently but not as frequently would be a native stack overflow, and that's where a stack pointer runs beyond the limits of a thread stack or an address range. And then another cause that we can see that I'm not going to focus on as much here but is still a valid reason or a valid excuse for a crash to occur would be either an out-of-memory in native code or a resource issue. And I think it's important to delineate the difference between an out-of-memory in native code versus an out-of-memory in heap. An out-of-memory in heap is when the actual Java heap gets depleted with referenced objects. This does not cause a crash generally. It's not a favorable result, of course, but you should get some diagnostics for out-of-memory out-of-memory errors that are handled, and then heap dumps and different diagnostics can be taken, which is really outside the scope of this. But when the native memory segment of a process becomes depleted, the results can be quite unpredictable, oftentimes involving a crash, sometimes just involving unpredictable behavior. And this is where, if we had an example of this would be if we had a native library that was referenced via JNI that didn't release its references or just was overutilized, and your heap was consuming the largest part of your address space, leaving very little space for the native memory. At that point, the JVM sometimes doesn't handle errors properly and can crash. Usually these are indicated with messages along the lines of unable to create thread or something along that, but they're definitely something to keep your eye out for. Other resource issues that I can think of would be insufficient file descriptors caused by U-limits or caused by a file descriptor leak or different types of things can also cause unreliable behavior or a crash. So, moving on to slide number 6, now that we've defined what a crash is for the scope of this presentation, I want to talk about the best ways to prevent these crashes. And basically, the first thing in prevention is staying current on your maintenance levels, and that is staying current on not only the level of the SDK, but also staying current on OS-level patches, which becomes especially important when working on HP or Solaris platforms. And any other supporting native libraries, such as any JDBC drivers, if you're using native library JDBC drivers, or any JNI code or vendor software that may have any native libraries within it. The reason I really want to push this point is because, from our perspective, when I say that the vast majority of TMRs are resolved via either updating the SDK or via tuning, when the numbers come down to what we actually send up to our development team for bug fixes, from a level 2 perspective, I believe that number is well under 10%. From a level 1 to level 2 perspective, it gets even higher. So we're really closing most of our PMRs or resolving most of our PMRs, a vast majority of them, by just maintaining the latest service level. Of course, I do understand that if you're in a production environment, you don't want to be applying patches at any given time. So as a best practice, we strongly recommend that whenever, for the cost of an application and its life cycle, that you factor in the maintenance costs of maintaining a QNA system to, in parallel, be keeping current with the latest maintenance levels and testing, and then moving those into production. So that's, and most of our customers are very good about, maintaining a QA system and staying on top. But, if there's ever some unforeseen reasons, such as a daylight savings time, that you'd need to update your SDK, it's always good to have it provisioned, as far as resources to be able to do that properly. So moving on to slide number 7, the second step after prevention is that if an unfortunate event occurs, we've got a set of documents that we have that we've developed over the years working with customers, working with different development groups, that we refer to as must-gather documents. We use the term as it's just a household term for us, and oftentimes our customers don't know what we're referencing. But I provided a link to that explains what a must-gather document is. But it aids in problem determination and saves time resolving problem, the PMRs themselves or the problem management records that come in. And the reason that these work is that they're a constantly evolving, proven set of documents that collect the necessary information that we need to do a postmortem, or even in some cases do a live analysis on a machine. one common issue that we run into is that the entire set of documents might not be collected just because only a certain number have been done, or for time constraints, or for whatever reason. I can't emphasize enough how important it is to have the entire picture, even if these documents don't look relevant, especially on the first pass. If we can collect the complete set of must-gather documents, it's also good for the customer for review. We can definitely prevent iterative collections of additional documents, because I know if you've had a system crash, the last thing you want to hear is, can you please crash again and collect these documents at this point? So if you can review those must-gather documents, I would say as a good practice, I would recommend almost a fire drill of ensuring that you have the necessary tools and permissions for the correct people to require that are required to collect documents on a crash, or that would be in attendance on the event of a crash to collect these. So as a best practice, I would recommend a almost fire drill of collecting the required documents. You'll oftentimes find that there's OS limitations or certain packages may not have been installed that prevent the proper diagnostics information from being collected, but oftentimes this is realized simply too late. So I would definitely recommend making sure that you're familiar with the must-gather document process. Okay, moving on to the next slide. Slide number 8. So now that we know what a crash is and what documents to look at, I want to go into basically where to start, where to do the first pass of where to look, and see if there's any low-lying fruit that might help us determine which component has failed or has caused this crash, and how to, you know, which component to focus on as far as applying maintenance or engaging support. For IBM SDKs, all signal handling is captured in the native underscore standard error.log. This is located in under, depending if you're on 5.0 or 5.1, under the install root log server name, or on 6.0 under the install root profile names log server name directory. This should capture, if you have verbose garbage collection enabled, which is usually a wise idea to have enabled it at any reason, this is where the documentation will be collected. But also, if there's ever a signal that's processed, like a signal 11 from a segmentation fault or access violation or anything like that, the JVM will process this signal, perform the diagnostics required, you know, perform some level of diagnostics before sending it back through to the operating system. So we'll basically interrupt that signal, try to generate a Java core, or try to generate some sort of diagnostics information, and then pass it down to the operating system, which in the case of a signal 11 will produce a full core file of that process. Moving on to slide number 9. On Sun and HP SDKs, we have, instead of the native standard error, this documentation is collected in the native standard out. It's not necessarily, it is signal information, but there's a little bit more information stored in here at the time of an error. The error, as I have an example here, of what kind of the error message would look like, or what the error information would look like. And it does give us a little bit of information about the version of the JVM, as well as it does also point to what the signal is, as well as what the actual failing library was. So on the Sun SDKs, we can actually check from on the first pass where the failing Sun and HP SDKs, we can see where the original failing component was. In this case, if you look down at the bottom of the slide, I've put in bold the library that caused the unexpected signal 11, as well as right above it is the function that was called. In this case, this was an on-demand component, and simply updating the libraries resolved the issue. And like I said, this is definitely something where we can avoid iterations of going into the help desk if you're empowered enough to know to look in this component and make sure that we know that the what the correct component is and how to and where to apply maintenance upgrades first. Moving on to slide number 10. Going in a little bit more depth on the IBM SDKs, in most cases, Java cores are going to be generated and show the failing module. I say most cases because, as we'll see later, there are times when, if there's a signal 11, that the signal handling of the JVM may not capture that or may not be able to provide diagnostics information, may just produce a system core. The if a Java core is generated, we can easily see the same information that we saw on the HP and Sun native standard out. And that's going to show us the time, the signal that was received, in this case, signal 11, what the exception code was, which I bolded here in the example as an access violation, the fault address, and what the failing module is. This is similar to the information that was stored in the native standard out on the HP and Sun JVMs. In this case, once again, we can see that it was a on-demand component DLL that made an access violation. There's another, if you go farther down in the Java core, there's a lot more additional information. If it's a native library of your own or if it's something that you have to debug, where we'll give the current thread that caused the issue. This is oftentimes valuable to know the method or the native stack itself that caused the problem. So at this point, we'd know, and once again, this was resolved simply by recommending an update of this of the on-demand component to the latest version, which resolved this issue as well. So moving on to slide number 11. In some cases, as I mentioned, the signal processing will fail or Java core won't be generated. Usually there will be a system core or a user dump that will be generated. We can use one of the diagnostics tools that ships with the WebSphere SDK called JExtract to basically process that system core or user dump to create what's called a portable core file. This portable core file is usually you'll see it as a user.sdff or a core.sdff as the extension. If you follow the must-gather directions, we'll walk you through the process of locating the JExtract and running it, and I've given an example down below here. What this will do is this will take the core file or user dump, generate a header with references into pointers into that, as well as collect any necessary libraries that may be machine-specific or problem-specific, and put all these into it. It's actually an archive. The SDFF file is actually an archive that can be unzipped and you can view it. The contents can including the user dump libraries, or I'm sorry, the core file libraries, or the user dump, which contains the references to the libraries, doesn't need that, as well as the header information. We can then take this information and, in theory, format it on any operating system. In theory, we should be able to do this in any operating system, but I have found that by far I have the best luck if I generate one on Windows, formatting it on Windows or parsing it later on Windows. Once again, it's very important to make sure that you're on the latest IBM SDK when you run this. One big reason for this is that the diagnostics tools, the JExtract tool itself, is constantly under improvement, and the later versions are vastly improved as far as collecting the complete set of libraries. So even if the crash didn't occur on that version of the SDK, having the latest version of the SDK later and using the JExtract utility from that will generally yield better results than using one from a previous or an earlier SDK. So moving on to slide 12. Once that SDFF file is generated, as I mentioned before, you can format this on a different machine. So if there's a need to get the diagnostic stuff off of the development team, or off the production machine, which I could certainly understand, it can be moved to another machine to be formatted. These files are generally pretty large, as a system core file is about the size of the process itself. So if you have about a 1.5 gig process, chances are you're going to have about a 1.5 gig SDFF or core file. You can use a utility that comes with 142, and I believe it's also in 131, called JFormat. This presentation does not cover 1.5 or the 6.1 WebSphere, but just as a note, JFormat was replaced on 6.1 or in the 1.5 SDK with a utility called JDumpView or JDMPView. More information on these, of course, are available in the serviceability guides, but you can utilize this utility to basically pull the Java core information out of the core file or out of the user.sdff file. By doing this, we can get back to the point where we have an easy-to-read, easy-to-format file that shows us the signal and the failing library and all the other information. The steps to do it, I've given an example, are right below there. You basically just load up the SDFF file and point it to an output file that you want it to have, and then type in Java core, and it should go and chunk away. Once again, it's very important to make sure you're on the latest SDK when you use these tools, because as I mentioned, some of the earlier ones are a little bit spottier as far as the reliability, but the later ones are certainly improving, and we're constantly investing in improving these tools as well. So Another thing referenced here is that we definitely have more details on JFormat, JExtract. The JFormat tool also has a GUI mode, which is a little bit easier to use and shows you a lot more of its functions. It's a fairly verbose set of tools. We have a good debugging API in the SDK, and this is very well documented in what we call the serviceability guides, and I've provided a link there. These are the de facto resource that support uses for referencing anything in the SDK, and is an invaluable resource if you ever have any questions on performance, tuning, crashes, debugging, or how the SDK works or what features are available within the SDK. Okay, moving on to slide number 13. Going back to Sun and HP, beyond what we have in the native standard out, generally on a crash, what will occur is you'll generally get what we reference as an HS underscore error PID file. This is sort of, I wouldn't say it's the equivalent of a Java core because I think the Sun puts a lot more of the information in the native standard out as opposed to putting it in the Java core, which IBM does, but it does provide some additional information. One thing that it provides is that, in addition, once again, the example I have here is an issue within the JVM itself, or that's what it would appear, because the failing library, as listed above, is a libjvm.so library. So at that point, we would assume that the issue is within the JVM and that the proper maintenance needs to be applied to it. There's generally an error code that will also get generated, and that's that error ID that I have listed down below there. That error ID is actually a hex representation of an ASCII string that will show the failing library. In most cases, it's going to be the same one here, this 4F530E, whatever. And that can be, usually you can take these, if they're unique, you can take them to Sun's bug database and search to see if anybody else has seen similar issues. If they're this 4F53E, this is actually a generic one that references us back to the os.cpp, or it's basically a generic failure. It didn't nail it down to a specific port or point in the SDK. In this example, and once again, this one was resolved, it's very important to keep the on the Sun and HP platform to keep the operating system J2SE cluster patches up to date. So in this case, we would certainly recommend that the J2SE cluster patches and the JVM itself are where we'd want to target our maintenance. Okay, moving on to slide number 14. So to ensure the best results, I want to restate that you always want to use the latest version of the SDK or debug tools. Even if the issue did occur on a previous maintenance level of the SDK, for the IBM SDKs especially, you want to make sure that you're using the latest version of the SDK to run the JExtract and JFormat. If support does need to be engaged, with the steps I've covered in this presentation, you should know which support organization to engage directly. You can make sure that you have a complete set of the requested must-gather documents, or at least as many as possible. The more complete this is, the faster the resolution will be, because the more pictures we can put together, more pieces of the puzzle we can put together and fully understand what's happened beyond the scope of a normal issue. And this is these documents are going to be required in any regards from the development teams that will need to provide the fix. If it's something that came from a third-party vendor or anything along those lines, once again, these documents are fairly common OS documents or OS commands that are run, so they're generally going to be what the third-party vendor is going to require regardless. So always preserve the crash documents as well, including the core files, until the root cause is determined. I know they're big files, but if it's at all possible, they do zip up a little bit, and you can just store them away on each occurrence to a certain degree, of course. You want to maintain a history of those so that we can compare them. Unfortunately, we have seen cases where a crash will occur, we'll get a set of documents, we'll have an idea of what it is and where to go, and as more crashes occur, it's been assumed it's the same problem, where it may be that we're simply peeling back the layers of an onion and there's another problem underlying that we need to get through one to get to the other. So it is important to review each set of crash documents and make sure that you're looking at the same problem on each one. So moving on to slide 15, as a conclusion, I want to reiterate that we want to start with prevention. This is really where we're seeing the most of our PMRs closed or most of our problem records resolved, especially involving crashes, by installing and updating to the latest maintenance level. You want to Once you're sure you're on the latest maintenance level, you want to identify the failing component, ensure the latest maintenance level of that failing component, whether that be the SDK, whether that be the JDBC driver, whether that be the vendor code, or any other native libraries involved from any of the many IBM products out there, or vendor products. You want to make sure you use the latest version of the debug tools. You need to collect and persist the correct complete logs and engage the correct team or vendor first. And this is when you call up IBM for support, we definitely want to be one image and one company to you, but there's definitely value in making sure that if the problem is in a specific component or a specific part of IBM, as opposed to contacting the box or the application server team, sometimes there's better value in contacting the appropriate team that owns the failing component first. So, once again, those are the big points that we need to cover from the conclusion. So now moving on to slide 16. This chart includes some links to a number of sites that provide some valuable online resources for WebSphere products. DeveloperWorks offers an in-depth technical information. The events link on support pages points you to webcast and conference information, and you can visit WebSphere.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly, and the ESR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Support link on the product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. So at this point, I'd like to pass the call back to the moderator.
Thank you, James, for a great presentation. And at this point, Steve, we would like to open the lines for questions. I will now turn the call over to James Fox.
And we're going to go first to Jimmy Sevilla.
Yes, I would like to find out what's the resource impact of turning on verbose GC.
There's actually very little. We document it as nominal, and I believe from the performance team when I was working there and we did benchmark tests, we'd leave it running because it was under 1%. In future releases of WebSphere, it's actually enabled by default. It's something that I'd recommend enabling as a best practice. The only concern is, of course, the log files and the size that they may grow to if not attended to over the course of a very long time. But it's in the later versions of WebSphere, we also have rotation on those log files, too, and there are ways to rotate it earlier on, too, in earlier versions as well. But the overall performance impact is nominal or under 1%.
We'll go next to Sivarajan Mohapad.
Thanks. I have a question about the J-Extract, which will be in local box, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is we'll take the dump file from, let it be Java code dump or maybe heap dump. Then we'll be running this tool to get what?
Well, it's the J-Extract tool is used only against the core file, the system core. It's not used against the Java core. The core file is the OS level dump of the actual process itself, such as on Windows, an example would be Dr. Watson would generate a user.dump file. On AIX, Linux, and other operating systems, it's just a core, sometimes with a PID appended to the end. And it in itself does not format the documentation, the core file for any specific output. What it does is it prepares that core file for to be basically moved off of the machine and then reviewed via other tools such as the JFormat tool. And the way it does that is it collects the core file itself. And I'm going to use the Unix platforms as an example. It'll collect the core file itself. It'll create some headers into that core file. It will then go through the core file and look at all libraries referenced by that core file and put all these things into one archive, which is the SDFF file, which can then be used later by other tools for review. The reason this is important is that we can't take just simply a core file from an AIX machine and open it up because our AIX machine does not have, or a different AIX machine may not have the exact same version of libraries that were involved in the crash on it, so we don't have the pointer information that would be required to debug it. So what we have to do is basically set up that environment with all the libraries from that core file or from that environment that had the crash locally or on a different machine. So in this case, if you wanted to run let's say, GDB or DBX or any of the debugging tools against a core file, you could do it on the machine the crash occurred on, or you could take that core file off of that machine and then either via the, in our MustGather, we have some scripts that will collect all the libraries, or by using the SDFF file, we can have all those libraries and work that problem on a different machine.
How's it going?
Thank you.
Once again, everyone, that is going to be star one for questions. We'll go next to John Pace.
Yeah, my question is, I'm here with Walmart, and my question is, I understand that this presentation is a lot for AIX concepts, but I wanted to know what would also be applicable to the mainframe when it comes to crashes and dumps and things of that nature.
I'll be honest with you, I'm probably not the best qualified to do that, but John, and I believe I've spoken with you, John, if you wouldn't mind sending me an email, I can probably hook you up with the right resources for those questions. I apologize, I may need to have been more specific on that, but the platforms that I'm covering were only for the AIX, Linux, Windows, and the Sun and HP, so, but I can, if you can, I've got my email address should be on the right of the presentation there, and I think I've talked with you a few times, John, so you know how to find me. But if you send me an email and preface it with the header WSTE, I can look up some resources for you regarding the mainframe stuff.
No problem.
We'll go next to Alpesh Kaptri.
Hi. I wanted to know, like, is there any way we can redirect the verbose GC output to a separate file other than native SDD out or L5?
Yes, you can. In the info center has directions on how to do that. I don't know the directions off the top of my head, but through the admin console, you can redirect the JVM's logs to any other file that you want. I don't recommend redirecting them to like the system out file, because the information then gets interlaced with the logging from the system out and the other ones. If you're going to redirect them, I'd recommend that you redirect them to a different or a unique file altogether. We've had some cases where customers have tried to redirect all their logging into one file, just to, I guess, consolidate stuff, and basically you get a lot of, it causes a little bit of an issue as far as readability or parsability by any tools. So if, the directions on how to do that are in the info center. If you have a problem or you're not able to find them, please give me a, send me an email. Once again, my email address is on the right there. It's the jfox@us.ibm.com. And if you want, I can, and just preface the subject line with the letters WSTE so I can identify it in my inbox, and I can point you to the specific directions.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go next to Krishna Goparaju.
Hi. My question is, what is the default behavior of the JVM in a Killman F11 condition? Is it going to create a Java core and heap dump also, or just Java core?
It's only going to create a Java core, and then that's going to create a system core, but it will not, by default behavior, it should not create a heap dump. There are some variables that you can enable, IBM underscore heap dump, and if it's true or if it's false, just its presence alone will make the JVM generate a heap dump on those signals. The diagnostics guide has a section on all the different ways you can manipulate the signal handling or what happens on it, what diagnostics information is dumped by default, but by default, or what diagnostics information is dumped at the time of any event, whether it be kill minus three and out of memory or a crash or any of those. But by default, the JVM is set up only to drop a Java core and then go to the system and get a system core.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a question from Randall Fote.
Yes, does IBM have any tools to do real-time monitoring of the heap to debug memory leaks?
There are some. Rational does have some tools. As far as, I'm trying to think, most of the tools we have are from heap dump perspective, are from either taking a snapshot and then taking another snapshot or doing it later, but I think what you're looking at are more profiling tools, and the Rational suite of products does have some profiling tools for doing that.
And do you know if those tools work with the 1.3 JVM, the 5.0?
Yes, they do.
Okay. On Solaris?
They won't. I don't believe they work. I don't know for certain that they work on Solaris. In fact, I'd be doubtful. Solaris and HP have, HP especially has some really good diagnostics tools for real-time monitoring. Solaris, I'll be honest with you, I don't know of any off the top of my head. If you want to, you can send me an email at that email address and preface it with a WSTE, and I can take a look for you, though.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take a question from William Hart.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, the question was enabling or disabling MQ signal handlers, and why would you or would you not want to do that?
Well, that was, that's not something we see so much anymore, but there was a point where, as the signal was being handled, MQ was basically intercepting the signals, and that could have prevented us from the signal ever reaching the JVM to give the signal to create the Java core to dump it out. So we recommend that now as kind of a blanket statement in our documents where we don't get a core file. It's certainly not as common anymore, but it just basically disables MQ's signal handling so it doesn't intercept the signals and prevent the JVM from producing any diagnostics information.
From a best practice, would you recommend setting that or not setting it?
At this point, quite honestly, as a best practice, I always, and I say this as literally, I think that you should go through a fire drill. I would not set it, and I would go through the must gather document by actually generating a core file, issuing a signal 11 to the process itself, and if it does create a core file, then you know that that everything's okay. You don't need that signal. If it does not create a core file, then you can either engage support, or we do have a must gather document on for each platform if it does not create the diagnostics information, which will then go through. There's actually a lot of different steps or a lot of different factors that can prevent a core file from happening. Stuff on Linux, I believe most Linux distributions, the U-limit for core is set to zero. Different things like that. So these are important things to discover before a real crash.
I understand. So would there be conditions that you would want to set that because you know it's going to happen or it might happen?
It's generally not something that you have to preemptively set. It's something that, and like I said, it's not something we see that often anymore. So I would say the best practice, I would not say that you need to have it disabled at all times, but I would basically, if you issue a kill minus 11 and you don't get a core file, that could be one of the causes. So there's a document that steps through all the different things that may be intercepting the signal or preventing the JVM from creating a core file.
Okay, would that be only for a kill 11?
I'm sorry?
Would that be only for a signal 11 that would come into play?
There are some cases where a 3, which doesn't kill the process but just generates a Java core, wouldn't occur. But, yeah, in this case, it would only come into play for signal 11.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Alan Kerr, Gangquat.
Hello, this is Naveen. I have a question. Is there any case which you have witnessed in the past wherein there has been a crash on the app server and there has been no entries put into the native errors or a core file being created? And if such a case exists, then what would be a way to identify the causes there?
There certainly has. It's not common, but we have seen instances where the process will disappear without any footprint, that being nothing in the native standard error. It's very rare that we won't see anything in the native standard error, but it has happened before. We actually have a tech note regarding that on when the JVM process exits without a footprint. And there's a couple of steps that we recommend in there. One of them, and it's sort of an iterative process because it's, like I mentioned, it's not something that we see very frequently, but we can disable JIT, and there's a couple of other disabling the signal handling altogether on the JVM is one other option that we have. And what that'll do is if there was a problem with the signal handling itself causing, you know, where the JVM has interrupted the signal and has tried to write out the diagnostics and has failed for some reason and has not allowed it to pass down to the OS to create the core file, that'll take that out of the picture. And there's some other steps. If you like, if you send me an email, the jfox@us.ibm.com, and preface it with the WSTE in the subject line, I can send you a link to the document that goes through the different steps on what to do in that instance.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go ahead and remind everyone, once again, that is star one for questions. And we'll go next to a follow-up, Sivarajan Mohapad.
Thanks. I'm Ranjan from Alton. I have a question, like, if we are going to turn on, I listened that we can turn on some rational profiler in production. Does it have any impact as performance? Does it take some more JVM resources?
Yes, it does. And I'm going to preface this with that the rational tool suite is definitely not my area of specialty, but I have used it before for some profiling. And the amount of impact varies. If I had to come up with a number off the top of my head, and you're not holding it to me, I'd say it's 15%. But it should be, that's in a worst-case scenario under heavy load, and depending on how many hooks you're using. Anything that uses the JVMPI interface for profiling or monitoring does cause a bit of a performance impact. In 1.5, that's lessened. That impact is actually, of the SDK, that impact is lessened greatly, and we change off of the JVMPI to a new format, but I don't recall the name of it off the top of my head. But I think the root issue with the 1.4.2 and 1.3.1 is that when you enable it, you're enabling all counters, and in 1.5, it'll actually allow you to selectively enable counters within the JVM. So you can greatly reduce the amount. But I wouldn't recommend, just depending on your production environment, I would say that profiling is an exercise that's best done for test or in other cases. If it's an instance where the issue only occurs in production, then you definitely want to run the profiling through a pre-production environment such as test and QA to get an understanding of the impact, because a lot of different factors like throughput, there could be a case where you have a lot of small objects coming on and off the heap, and that would cause more impact than a normal flow type thing. So I can't really quantify a specific blanket number, but there is a good performance impact when using a profiler.
Thank you.
And at this time, no further questions in the queue, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you, Steve. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation as well. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will also be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you, James, for presenting today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, everyone, that does conclude today's teleconference. We do appreciate your participation. You may disconnect at this time.